Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And thanks to Ian and them for not hanging up on me, man. I had to restart my computer the hard way. I didn't log in until the music was already playing. But all right, so just in the nickel of the dime, I made it here. Hey, it's my show, the Scott Horton Show, and the thing is, basically I interview journalists about the wars and stuff. That's basically the thing. Today on the show, you know what? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you in write a blog entry form. Today's show, whoops. Well, I can't type very well. That's just part of the deal. Today's show. Megan O'Toole. Murtaza Hussein. Oops. And, oh, I guess I don't need the and. And Gareth Porter. Of course, Gareth. Well, what happened was I was going to try to talk to him yesterday, but things didn't work out, so I'm going to try again today. That's the deal. In case you care, this blog entry is being written up at my blog, The Stress Blog, which is at Scott Horton Show. No, scotthorton.org/stress. scotthorton.org/stress. Although I admit I don't really blog there. I keep trying to wanting to blog on my own damn blog, but I just never do it. I don't know why. I used to, but it's been a long time ago now. But anyway, I always blog today's show there, in case anybody's interested. Put the same thing on Twitter for you too, for you Twitterers. Megan O'Toole, she's going to be on about the horrifying situation in Yemen, America's war in Yemen. And Murtaza Hussein is going to be talking about the war in Egypt, America's terrible war in Egypt. Well, sort of, kind of. And Gareth Porter is going to be on to talk about the war in Syria, America's terrible war in Syria. Wars and wars and wars. Yeah, today's show. It's like every day's show. Wars and wars and wars. Alright, backup recorder's running too. That's good. Just in case, you know. 107 troops missing after Boko Haram destroys Nigeria base. Wow. Remember right before the declaration of the caliphate, I had Michael Scheuer on the show, and I was telling him, Michael Scheuer, there's going to be the declaration of the caliphate any day now, and then a full-scale war there again. And he was like, I don't know, man, I think it's going to be in West Africa. And I was like, well, you know, I think it might happen in West Africa, but I think that the Islamic State, that's where it's really at. Remember that? 107 troops missing. You know what? This sounds like a case for American intervention. Remember Jeremy Keenan was on the show talking about the consequences of the war in Libya. America's terrible war in Libya. And how it spread down to America's terrible war in Mali. And how the Mali war spread to the Nigerian's horrible war with Boko Haram. But then, the American help for the Nigerians and their clampdown against Boko Haram has just pushed them across the borders into neighboring Chad and Niger, which is why Obama just... Remember this? This got a headline for about half an hour. This was in the news cycle for about half an hour a couple of weeks back. Obama sends troops to Cameroon. Not to help with flooding or something. No, it's a war. They're going to contain That's what they call it. Contain the consequences of their last intervention by causing some more consequences and spreading them around so that they can contain them too. It's a racket. That's what Jacob Hornberger calls it. The containment racket. Hey, look at us. We're containing the problem. Now as we spread it. That is kind of disconcerting, though, isn't it? That Boko Haram is that powerful compared to an army base full of Nigerian troops? Trained by the best! Red, white, and blue. Guess we'll see what happens there. Anyway. Yeah, three big interviews today, so I better get to the news I wanted to talk about here. That's what happens when I double-check the headlines on antiwar.com before, right before the show or right during it. All right, we covered all that Iraq stuff yesterday. The top headline is more troops. NBC, the Pentagon is going to spend. They're going to spend more U.S. troops in Syria. Yeah, that too. That's the top headline on antiwar.com today. Oh, and this goes along with our next story. Let's see if I can work together a nice radio segue here. Hillary Clinton tells CBS News she, quote, can't conceive any condition under which she would put U.S. combat troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria. She's the one calling for the safe zone that the Pentagon says would require at 30,000 troops. And of course by that they mean 70,000 or 150. Well, I can't conceive of any I'll tell you what, I am not going to send your boys off to fight in any foreign wars. We're not going to have Americans dying fighting battles that little Asian boys should be fighting themselves. Just have a reach right back into the playbook of all-time great. Oh, I know. Troops home by Christmas. How about that? Whatever it is Democrats said about wars and how they're not going to be fought or they'll be over soon. Just quote them for us, Hillary. And that is the segue into, sort of kind of clumsily, into this other article. The very odd effects, and this is the Washington Post, so that's why to them. It's notable to us, but not odd, I don't think. Shouldn't be. The very odd effects of the Paris attacks on the 2016 campaign. And it's by Dan Dresner, who is a very conventional thinker there at the Washington Post. And maybe, I think he might be a Democrat, but just not very far to the left, you know, kind of a Washington Post sort of a writer. And anyway, he says, well, geez, everybody expected for everybody on the campaign trail to become much more Rubio and to bluster that much louder about how much more violence they're going to bring to the Middle East. And yet, what do we see? We see Hillary Clinton obviously lying, but at least still claiming because she thinks it's necessary that she can't conceive of any possible situation where she's going to reinvade Iraq or invade Syria. Oh, no, I just can't conceive of a thing like that. And then he goes on to point at Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz, of course, is the Tea Party Republican who is distancing himself, as Dresner, I think, quite correctly puts it, from the neocon point of view. He attacks Rubio. I don't know if, you know, I didn't read the whole quote, but the part that Dresner quotes, Cruz isn't necessarily bringing up Rand and saying, oh, I don't agree with him. He's too much of a peacenik. But he's saying, I sure as hell don't think that we should be fighting this civil war in Syria. And my enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend and this kind of thing. Because that's good politics. Because the American... Oh, and same for Trump, too. Doesn't want any further intervention in Syria. Because it's good politics for Republicans. In the Republican primary, that's what Republican dads want to hear right now in America. Finally.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, guys, coming up, three great interviews. Well, I mean, I'll try my best. I'm sure they're going to be fine, you know. Here's how to support this show. You go to scotthorton.org/donate. Read all about it there. I'll take your bitcoins. I'll take your dollars. Obviously, PayPal is easiest. You can sign up for monthly subscriptions where you donate $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. As people do. I am very appreciative, by the way. And yeah, you know, one-off donations are fine, whatever you got. There's one guy donates a penny a week. That's pretty good, dude. 50 cents a year, 52. That's, you know what, if everybody gave that much, it would be more than they're giving now. So that's cool, too. However you want to do it. I sometimes wonder whether you tried to sign up for $10, but probably not because it's weekly, you know. I think it's just, hey, here's what I got, man. It's a penny, take it. All right, cool. That's cool. Anyway, so, but what I really like you to do is advertise your company on the show. And if you do that, if I can get a few more of you guys to do that, then I won't have to, you know, seek donations at all. I'll just barely make a living and that'll be fine. But I gotta bring this stuff up every once in a while. Need y'all's support. And for those of you who like it, I know from your emails and from talking to you and stuff that you really like it. So, if you really do, it's sort of like, you ever see on The Simpsons? I guess it's an anachronism now, but when they go to the museum and it's a suggested donation, and Homer's going, what? You don't have to pay, but you expect people to pay anyway? What? That's what it is, basically. You don't have to. But if you donate money to support the show or you buy ads on the show, something like that, then you're helping other people get it for free. So that's nice. It's the end of the year. It's been a bad year for the world. You got to have somebody telling the truth about it all the time, right? ScottHorton.org/donate if you're interested. Okay, now I gotta go back to the politics thing here for a second. Can't help it. I'm sorry, guys. I really am. I can't help it. I gotta talk about Rand Paul. And what a world historical level failure he is and has been. And how horrible his campaign for presidency has been. And what a letdown. Jesus. You know what it is? It's like Ron Paul is a Federal Reserve generated bubble, and then Rand is the crash. He's just so damn disappointing. You know, I saw someone tweet out yesterday, Rand Paul, hawks in our party helped to create ISIS. I was like, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, and I thought, yeah, right. I know he didn't say that recently. And I clicked on it, and of course it's from May or March of this year. Because when he was asked about that in the debate, obviously he was warned that they were going to ask him, and he had a very practiced line ready to go. He didn't say, no, I never meant to say that, but he did completely disavow it and say only ISIS is responsible for ISIS, and his campaign sent out a tweet at the exact moment he was saying it. To prove just how premeditated it all was. They weren't quoting him. It was already cocked and loaded and ready to hit send on. Ready to hit post. or whatever the hell. What does the button say? Anyway. He's been running away from his father's position. That's all he has to do. Well, on this whole time and on almost everything. On virtually everything. But on the wars, all he has to do, and this guy, that's all any of us have to do. But all he has to do is just read Ron. Ron writes an article every week, and he's always right about everything. And it's not just because he has good principle. He really knows what the hell he's talking about. Ron Paul reads a lot, and he pays attention, and he's got good principle. And, you know, he's been keeping track of the different lies as they switch back and forth. He doesn't. And his articles are just killer. You go through the antiwar.com archive for Ron Paul and read what he's been writing for the last dozen years, and you will have an education of American Middle East policy, bar none. It's great. He's as good as Justin. Maybe more consistent, actually. But Rand is just blowing it. And you can see the conventional wisdom at play here, where Ted Cruz goes, well, I want to sound a little bit like Rand, but a little tougher, right? Well, I'm all for killing people for the national interest, but I don't go for this building democracy and supporting moderates and all this hippie crap, right? He's accusing Rubio of being a Hillary Clinton do-gooder. He's not calling him George W. Bush, same thing. But he's saying, all this remake the world for their own good stuff? Nah. Give me good old-fashioned American interests only. That's what Ted Cruz is saying. And what Rand is saying is, yeah, like me. See, I'm like Ted Cruz. That's what I think, too. But that's not his spot. His spot is national interest. Let me tell you about national interest, all right? The entire empire should be abolished immediately. That is in America's national interest. Start yesterday. That is America's national interest. And let's fight about it. Korea, Iran, Iraq, ISIS, Assad or Baghdadi. You know, any of these things. Let's squabble. All Rand has to do is read his dad and understand it and say that. But he won't. He could be moving the ball forward for peace and for liberty in American society right now, maybe even in a way that would, you know, outshine his father in comparison kind of thing, because he is a senator and not just a humble congressman. And when Ron ran for president in 2007, when he announced he was running for president, he had run as a libertarian back in 88, but that kind of doesn't count. When he first started running in 2007, no one in America had heard of him, except us libertarians, right? There was one of us in every neighborhood who had heard of him, but nobody else. So he had to go from no name recognition whatsoever to the global phenomenon. All Rand had to do was say, oh, hell yeah, what my dad says is right. I'm, you know, whatever. I'm my own man and everything, but he's a brilliant genius. Listen to him. That's all he had to do. And say, he's just like George W. Bush. Yeah. I know better than my dad. What does he know? I know what to do. Eh. And said, nope, he doesn't know what to do. He sucks. He's completely blowing it. You got Donald Trump doing just like Cruz. And Cruz is mimicking Trump in this too. Oh yeah, we're a hardcore right-wing nationalist when it comes to killing people in limited circumstances. But we're not for this, you know, unending global empire thing. That means, in other words, that the right-wing audience, and they know it. This is Donald Trump, the front runner by far. They know the right-wing audience is ready to hear a message of peace. If only somebody's man enough to give it to them. And so that's as close as they're going to get. And where's Rand? Nowhere.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commodity discs. CommodityDiscs.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, Liberty Radio Network, etc. First up today is Megan O'Toole. She is an online journalist and producer on the Middle East desk at Al Jazeera English, and reports primarily on law and politics. But this one is called Starvation in Yemen. We are hoping just to survive. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. Sad for the occasion, but happy to see this journalism being done. There's not nearly enough of it along these lines. The war's been going on, of course. America and Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen, or the Houthi regime now in Yemen, since March. And the blockade has been going on at least as long, I guess. I'm not really clear when, in fact, it really kicked in. But the bombing has basically been ceaseless this whole time. And we've been told, Megan, from the very beginning of this thing, by all the human rights organizations, maybe they were overestimating somewhat, I'm not sure, that the people of Yemen, already the poorest country in the Middle East, are 80 to 90% dependent on foreign imports of food. And that the blockade was you know, risking basically millions of lives were subject to the threat of starvation. And so, but then again, that's a lot of months have gone by without a lot of food. So could you please fill us in on just how bad it's been, how bad it is now, what's being done, what can be done? Go right ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it is, it's become a massive humanitarian crisis now in Yemen. I mean, this war, as you said, it's been going on since March. There are people across the country who have basically reached a crisis point. The latest numbers actually are saying that basically around 14 million people in Yemen, so that's more than half of the people who live in Yemen, have become food insecure. And of those, 7 million are severely food insecure. So, you know, a huge amount of the population is having trouble just putting food on the table. And, of course, there's a variety of reasons for that. There are various areas that are under siege. There are the ports, difficulty in getting any ships in because of the situation in Yemen. You know, jobs, people have lost their livelihoods. They've been displaced from their homes. They've had to leave everything behind. You know, you don't have functioning water in a lot of homes. There's just this confluence of factors that have led to millions of people being in a state that's really, it's an emergency state is what it's categorized as. And there is a risk of, you know, mass famine in Yemen. It's reached a point that people are starting to realize something needs to be done. And, of course, there are humanitarian organizations trying to do what they can, but it's quite challenging to operate in Yemen today, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's really a big part of it, right, is even the relief organizations and the media have so much trouble traveling there compared to the average war zone, Megan? I don't know. Seems like they're not able to help very much, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, obviously, you know, the fighting has targeted some key infrastructure. I mean, there's bridges that have been damaged and destroyed. There's borders that have been shut down. There are issues getting food in and out of the port areas because, of course, there's this arms embargo that's been in place. And so there's a lot of inspections that need to be done on any large commercial ships, and some of them have been turned away. Yeah, it's a very difficult area, and all, you know, there's parts of the country that are very difficult to reach as it is, and even harder when you have some of the main roads and key infrastructure like that destroyed. So as much as there are groups that are trying to assist, it's challenging. And we have cities like Taiz as well, where basically the Houthis have laid siege to the city now. So, you know, everyone in there is kind of trapped in this worsening state. I mean, across the country, it's really difficult right now for people.
Mm-hmm. But now, are people actually starving to death? They always seem like they're on the brink of it, and more on the brink, but are they really dropping dead of no calories, or how's it going?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's necessarily figures on exactly what that is. I'm sure we'll start to see more of that as this continues. But certainly families that we've spoken to at Al Jazeera have talked about how difficult it has become for them. I mean, it just in order to put meals on the table for their family at night. So there's a variety of ways that people are coping. I mean, some people have started cutting down the number of meals that they're having per day. So maybe they'll just have one meal a day instead of three. They might skip a meal. They're eating different foods as well, which is also a bit of a problem, not getting necessarily all of the nutrients they need because more expensive foods are cut. So things like, you know, meat and vegetables and some dairy products were among the top products that people are cutting out. You're also seeing food prices rising dramatically. So things like a bag of wheat, you know, it's just I think something like 50% higher than it was in February now. So, I mean, it's a challenge for people to get even the basic food items that they need. And so people have made a lot of changes. It's the kind of situation where if it continues like this for much longer, it's going to be very difficult for people to survive, especially as we get into the winter season.
Yeah. Well, and people can imagine, right? I mean, if you have a bombing campaign going on at all, an aerial bombing campaign, that basically means the end of all the previous distribution networks. I mean, maybe somebody's going to set up some way of smuggling this or that good or, you know, here or there, but all the typical ways of doing things are over. Roads are destroyed, you know, convoys are targeted and, you know, whatever kind of thing. So, you know, all the market systems have to at least be reset if they can survive at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, access becomes a problem for everybody. And, you know, anyone trying to get into the country, it's a huge deterrent because they don't know what they're going to face. So people either aren't coming in or they're not even being able to come in certain areas because of the border issues or other access routes being destroyed or damaged. So, yeah, it's very difficult.
Mm. Well, and we saw in Somalia when the Horn of Africa was undergoing their terrible drought, the Somalis had it the worst because of America, they'd been at war. And so, you know, where Eritrea and Ethiopia were very hard hit, in Somalia, yeah, 500,000 people laid down and died, something like that. According to FuseNet, who you're citing in this article in reference to Yemen here, they said that 600,000 people, I think, they said had died. And, of course, most of those being children under five, because guess who's weakest and dies of starvation easiest?
Well, that's exactly it. And yeah, as you're talking about FuseNet. Yeah, they've looked at this issue as well in Yemen with regards to young children. And so they are actually, you know, higher levels of morbidity among children have been seen in Yemen as well. So there was actually, they surveyed several governorates in Yemen, and one of them in particular in Abyan, it went up something like four times in the admissions of malnourished children from 2014 to 2015. And, you know, similar data from other hospitals that were surveyed. So, I mean, definitely the levels of death among young children are increasing. And I mean, that's tragic because these children are, you know, they're caught in something. They're, you know, some of them born into a situation. They have no control over it. And it's really just a tragic situation for a lot of people in Yemen.
Hmm. Well, and it seems like, you know, the media is not doing very much coverage of this, except the coverage of reactions from the, you know, so-called, you know, international civil society and whatever, and the NGOs, the Red Cross and all their clones, you know, who are concerned. Their concerns are the only things that make the paper about it at all, for the most part. Otherwise, there's virtually no coverage of it, but they all seem to be in a real state of panic over this.
They are. And I think, I mean, well, two things there. I think that it's actually become quite difficult for a lot of media to operate in Yemen today because the security situation has deteriorated quite badly since this campaign began in March. And so it has become unsafe for a lot of journalists to operate there. I mean, there are still some journalists who are operating in Yemen, but it's increasingly challenging. And of course, for humanitarian organizations as well, you know, difficult for them to operate as well. But of course, I think when they do release this kind of data, I mean, people do sit up and pay attention because it is quite stark. When you hear numbers, you know, 14 million people, you know, who have become food insecure and 7 million people extremely insecure. I mean, these are numbers that I think it's hard for people to ignore, even if they have heard these sorts of facts in the past. It's difficult to ignore.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, hold it right there, everybody. We got to take this break. And then we'll be right back with Megan O'Toole writing for Al Jazeera. This is called Starvation in Yemen. We are just hoping to survive.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Megan O'Toole. She's a writer for Al Jazeera, producer for Al Jazeera. And she's the co-author of this piece, Starvation in Yemen. We are hoping just to survive. And as she stated at the beginning here, what it comes down to is 14 million people in danger of starvation, and 7 million, I'm not exactly sure how they categorize it, but 7 million in bad danger, real bad, short-term danger of dying of starvation here because of the American and Saudi war in Yemen. And I know that this goes at least beyond the scope of your reporting in this piece, Megan. I don't know whether you've reported on this in the past, but it's clearly on the record in the Los Angeles Times and the Wall Street Journal and other very, very official publications like that, based on very, very official statements and sources, that American military and civilian, government employees are over there helping with this war, coordinating the war, maintaining the Saudis' planes, providing midair refueling, helping them pick their targets. And so it's very much America's war, even though the headlines we'll always usually refer to it as a Saudi war. It couldn't possibly exist without America's aiding and abetting the entire operation. So it's sort of plausible deniability for the, you know, Sunday morning news shows or whatever, but not for real life. So stop and make that plain here, that when we're talking about these people starving to death, we're also talking about Obama could stop it today if he wanted to, but he won't. And so, important point about the responsibility on this side of the Atlantic and everything here. But so, now as far as anything being done about it, I guess there have been a few trial balloons and whatever. Are you keeping track of this? Is there a chance of any kind of, you know, real peace talks happening anytime soon? Because it seems pretty obvious there's not going to be a military victory for either side or any side.
Yeah, well, I mean, there have been attempts to hold negotiations, and obviously, as you know, they haven't gone so well so far. There are new efforts trying to be launched to have negotiations again, but apparently, according to reports, they've been thwarted by Hadi, who's worried that a negotiated settlement could drive him out of power. This is according to diplomats who are following the situation. There's been a number of attempts, and in fact, even before this started, this whole war started, there was an attempt to negotiate a solution to the conflict in Yemen. And in fact, some sources have said that they were quite close to striking a deal before this military intervention. But then the Houthis started expanding south. And so they overreached, and this prompted the air offensive, and things kind of spiraled out of control there. But, there are a number of issues, obviously. It doesn't look like they're close to resolving them anytime soon, but I think it's fair to say that there have been a number of missed opportunities over the course of this conflict where parties were at the table, and a number of issues had been hammered out, and it was a matter of kind of getting to the finish line, and that just hasn't happened. And so at this point, it's not really, I mean, we're not seeing an end in sight. That's not to say it can't happen, but it's just not looking particularly optimistic at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it doesn't seem like the West is very concerned with pressuring the Saudis to wrap it up anytime soon at all either, does it?
Not particularly. I mean, I think you mentioned earlier that, you know, this is a conflict that hasn't received a whole lot of attention in the West, and I think that's a fair point. It hasn't, and I think it's difficult for some people in the West perhaps to relate to what's happening in Yemen today. And I suppose it's also a factor of the news cycle that stories like this that are ongoing don't tend to get as much attention. I mean, certainly we've been following it closely and, you know, following each development closely, but it may not be getting as much attention as it should be there in order to pressure other parties to take the action that is required to kind of to try to bring this to an end.
Right. Yeah, if there's no political pressure to make them take it seriously or do something about it, then they'll just move right on to the next thing, I guess. You know, Huckabee's latest statement is going to get the clicks or whatever.
Well, this is it. And, I mean, also, if you look at the situation in the Middle East region right now, I mean, there are so many other conflicts ongoing. It's almost like this one has been somewhat sidelined by the amount of other conflicts ongoing. I mean, the war against ISIL right now is getting the majority of attention. And while that impacts all areas of the Middle East, obviously Yemen as well, attention is being focused right now on Iraq and Syria, the heartland of ISIL. And I think at the moment, that's where the public is watching. That's where the resources are being focused. And that's really the conflict that people are watching right now. And so Yemen has kind of fallen to the wayside of it. Mm.
Well, and of course, ironically, we're fighting a war for the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, their competition there in Yemen right now, at least in effect, by fighting their worst enemies, the Houthis.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's interesting in Yemen is, of course, we've seen that Al-Qaeda they've taken advantage of the situation in Yemen to basically expand their reach. I mean, the situation of chaos is something in which they thrive. And so, you know, there was incidents where Al-Qaeda has freed hundreds of their prisoners, you know, in parts of the country where basically things have fallen into a state of chaos and certainly taken advantage of this situation to recruit and to, you know, to bring their numbers up. So that's a great concern as well, because it's well known that, you know, groups like Al-Qaeda can use these situations to their advantage. And that's certainly what they're doing in Yemen.
Yeah. And now, I guess it sounds silly to put it this way, but is it somewhat true that this comes down to a fight between a former president and his replacement vice president? And they are the armies that each side is leading here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated situation. I think there's more to it, but I think it can be boiled down to, I mean, certainly the Houthis have links to Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president of Yemen. And, you know, a lot of this conflict is they have been targeting supporters of the 2011 uprising. And comments have been made that the reason negotiations failed in the past was because the Houthis and the Salehs, their alliance, was only interested really in putting an end to Yemen's transitional period, and that's what this conflict was about. I mean, so it's interesting. You're just basically watching this power struggle unfold, and the Houthis did take over quite a bit of territory before this event started. I mean, this was going on for a while before the Saudis intervened. So it's, yeah, it comes down to a power struggle, ultimately. That's the simplest way to put it, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's amazing that Saleh has teamed up with his enemies, the Houthis, who he had attacked on four different occasions. He started real wars with, I think, four different times before, and now he's allied with them. And, well, let me ask you about this, if you know about it. And I'm sorry because it's not in your article, but, you know, as long as we're talking Yemen war. The war hawks all say, well, you know, Iran controls the Houthis, and they're Iranian-backed. They don't ever really get into details because it doesn't seem like they have very many. But their implication is that the Houthis are just the cat's paws of Iran. But then the other side says, that's not really true so much. But they don't have much of a, you know, much to say about it, you know, or much of a description of what is and what isn't true, to what degrees they have political or economic or military links or anything. It seems like a very vague kind of accusation and counter on both sides. So I wonder, you know, what you think of that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, certainly, I mean, Iran's faced accusations of actually providing physical military support to the Houthis. And, you know, they've denied those charges in the past. But I mean, certainly, this whole war is being viewed in some circles as you know, again, Saudi versus Iran, which is the age-old, rivalry. And the fact that these airstrikes are an effort, sort of a broader weapon to curb Iran's influence in the region. Of course, that's ongoing in a number of spheres right now. But, yeah, to what extent that'll play out, I guess, remains to be seen.
Yeah. But as far as any, you know, links between them, do you know? I mean, whether one side is really more right than the other, or, you know, to what degree, on a scale of 1 to 10, how close are they? Something.
I think there's others probably more qualified to comment on that, but
yeah.
I mean, I think that there's certainly been a number of indications of military support, and there have been denials. So I mean, we can kind of look at both sides and you know, make our own assumptions based on that.
Yeah. I admitted before, so I'll let you off the hook. I did say, I admit it's not in your article. I'm not basing the question off of that, but it just seems like something that everybody's talking about, and both sides of the argument never seem to really make a case either way very much,
well,
you know?
Well, this is it. I mean, I think it's difficult for anyone to kind of definitively say, you know, who's right and who's wrong. And actually, I mean, there's a lot of accusations flying around on both sides, and there have been for many months now. So it's kind of, I think everyone has to kind of look at this and make up their own mind as to what they really think is going on.
Right. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate your article here and your time on the show, Megan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
All right, y'all. That is Megan O'Toole from Al Jazeera, producer there and co-author of this piece, Starvation in Yemen. We are hoping just to survive, at Al Jazeera. .com, and we'll be right back.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com.
Okay, guys, welcome back. Well, we had to do the news, man. All right, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next is Murtaza Hussein, writing for The Intercept at TheIntercept.com. ISIS recruitment thrives in brutal prisons run by U.S.-backed Egypt. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Murtaza?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing good. Very happy to have you back on the show. Very happy to read this journalism. Very important stuff that you have here. We'll be running it tomorrow, if we're not already running it on antiwar.com. So let's go ahead and get into this here. Who is Mohammed Sultan?
Mohammed Sultan is an American citizen who was detained in Egypt after the military coup in 2013. And he was in prison for roughly 2 years, and for over a year he was on a hunger strike in Egypt, and he lost about 130 pounds, and he was in a very dire physical state, which ultimately resulted in the U.S. government putting pressure on the Egyptian government to release him before he died. This article, which is published at Intercept, documents some of the things he saw in jail, and the way that recruiters for groups like ISIS would use the brutality of the Egyptian government as a recruiting tool.
Mm-hmm. All right. So in telling his story, could you turn speakers down just a little bit? It'll help with that feedback there. Your volume sounds fine though. So in telling his story in the article here, you revisit the way that he and his father were arrested and, you know, came to be in jail as part of the story of the revolution of the Arab Spring in Egypt in 2011 and the counter-revolution in 2013, that these two were caught up in. So maybe if you could just remind everybody real quick about how that all came about.
Right. So in 2013, after the coup in Egypt that deposed the first democratically elected government in Egyptian history, even though it was not a government which is popular with everybody, of course, It resulted in this wide-ranging crackdown on all facets of Egyptian society, leftists, liberals, Muslim Brotherhood members, Salafis, anyone basically who was dissenting from the new military government. Now, Mohammed Sultan's father was part of the Morsi government. He was a minister in that government, although Mohammed Sultan himself was not part of it and, in fact, was opposed to the Morsi government's policies in most regards. Like a lot of Egyptian families, just like a lot of Syrian families, you'll see a lot of polarization within families. So he had uncles who were part of the Sisi government, and he had other relatives who were part of the Morsi government. And there really was a lot of acrimony and animosity over these political divisions. And then after, in 2013, when the coup occurred, and there was a huge massacre of protesters who supported the Morsi government in Cairo, Mohammed Sultan was among those shot and later detained by the government, which commenced this long prison ordeal. Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. I had my mic off. I was trying to be polite, but then I overdid it.
Huh.
You say that while Mohammed Sultan was in prison, that the Islamic State, there are different factions, all, as you say, they were all rounded up together, whether they had anything to do with each other or not, and they're all kind of in there, and that the Islamic State is a very powerful faction. I guess we could think of, you know, parallels to, white supremacist gangs in American prisons or something like that. They're one of the dominant factions in there. And so what was it about their shtick that he thought was so newsworthy he would share with you?
You know, there are so many different factions in these prisons, and Islamic State doesn't really have a presence in Egypt per se, but the nature of the group is that it's not really, you don't have to fill out a membership form or be part of anything. You can just pledge allegiance to it. Anyone can just pledge allegiance to it just in by their word of mouth, and then they can start claiming that they support the group. So what he told me is that there are a lot of people in jail who maybe they had they were part of different factions before, but once they were in jail, everyone gets news of the outside world, and people know what's going on, and people start pledging allegiance to Islamic State. And there were a few people who were in there who were jihadists, and they said, well, you know, we're down with Islamic State now. And they, but in between, you know, these horrible torture sessions, because Egyptian prisons are notorious for their extreme implementation of torture and murder and all these other things, they would, everyone would get together and talk, and it would be all the groups, the liberals, the Islamists, the jihadists, and the jihadists would tell them, look, like, you guys, all of you, you put your trust in democracy, and then democracy happened, and the world didn't even respect you enough to think that you deserve to have it, and now the guy who killed your friends and your family members is being feted in Washington and at Davos and London. And all these world leaders are shaking his hand and arming his regime, and no one cares about you. And, you know, it's, he said, what he told me is they'd listen to these guys give their kind of, their talk on the subject, and at the end of it, no one really knew how to rebut it, because technically it was all true. And their conclusion was, well, you should join ISIS, and people, because the only world only understands force, and at the end of the day, they don't believe in values, and the only thing they understand is violence. And he said that everyone was speechless just because of the gravity of the situation they were in and the things which were being said. There was not really any other alternative argument to make. They just were quiet.
Yeah. It's such an amazing story. You know, Adam Morrow from Interpress Service is a journalist who lives there in Cairo. And we talked about all of this in real time, you know, from the real revolution that overthrew Mubarak through the counter-revolution, the fake one, a year and a half later there, and how it all happened, and how the Muslim Brotherhood, like them or not, I mean, however you characterize them, they were rich old men, and therefore conservative. They're not fire-breathing, suicide-bombing radicals like Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda, or even maybe Syrian Muslim Brotherhood guys who, you know, had maybe even more reason to be that much more radical, that kind of thing. But these were, this was basically the civilian Republican Party of Egypt. And what America did was, and it was so obvious at the time, again, it's not even told you so, or, you know, 2020 hindsight kind of thing. It's more, yeah, told you so in real time, that by overthrowing them and rounding up all their supporters and putting them all in prison, all they're doing was proving Al-Qaeda right, that America doesn't really support democracy. And if they ever had democracy and if we had self-rule in our own countries, then we would kick them out. And so they'll never allow it. And then I think I had missed at the time. I don't remember noticing this at the time. I think I'd missed at the time, and I only found it years later. Someone brought it up to me that Zawahiri actually did put out a podcast in August of 2013 saying, "I told you so." And there's a whole write-up on it. And he's saying, "Isn't this exactly what I said?" So I had been saying, you know, I bet Zawahiri is saying, "I told you so," just assuming because he did. And no, in fact, yeah, he's taking exact credit for that and saying that, you know, the Americans will do anything to prevent the people of the Arab world from ruling themselves. And so this proved him exactly right. As you said, technically, regardless of the fact that they're ISIS guys or Al-Qaeda guys making the argument, technically, facts are facts. And so what are they supposed to do about it? It just makes perfect sense that somebody fresh out of the torture chamber is going to find this argument appealing, just like Ayman al-Zawahiri found it appealing, as you note in your article, back in the late 70s or 80s, whenever it was, when he was rounded up with the rest of the Muslim Brotherhood and was tortured by Mubarak.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it really sucks, but it just plays exactly into their narrative. And the birth of Islamic radicalism, it happened in Egyptian prisons. That's where it happened in the post-colonial era with the torture of all these guys and people like Sayyid Qutb, who end up being the most, and Ayman Zawahiri, who end up being the most influential and dominant figures in this movement, you know, in the modern era. It's because these guys all underwent the horrible torture of the Egyptian prison system, which the U.S. has long known as abusive, and, you know, they've even used that abuse to their advantage in certain circumstances by sending people they know or they want to have tortured to Egypt. There was this famous quote by Robert Baer after 9/11. He was a former CIA agent saying that when we wanted someone to disappear and never see them again, we'd send them to Egypt in our rendition program.
Absolutely. All right, now, I'm sorry. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept. You got to read this thing. ISIS recruitment thrives in brutal prisons in U.S.-backed Egypt.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm doing interviews, as is my wont. Talking with Murtaza Hussein, reporter for The Intercept, and he's got this great story about a guy named Mohammed Sultan, who's an American citizen who was kidnapped and tortured by the Egyptian military dictatorship, which is, of course, a wholly owned subsidiary of the American Empire. And at the break, I almost interrupted you to say it. I'm glad I didn't. Murtaza, you brought up the great Robert Baer quote. If you want them to, if you want them tortured, you send them to Syria. If you want them to disappear forever, you send them to Egypt. And that was before the. You had a very early year on that quote. I didn't realize you're talking before the extraordinary rendition program of George W. Bush ever started. He was talking Clinton years. This is how business is done. Mubarak's torture prisons. I got that right?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. And of course, we know the rendition program does go back to the Clinton years. Right. Absolutely, certainly. I wanted to mention too that in Loretta Napoleoni's great work on Zarqawi, she shows that he was nothing but a two-bit rapist until he was tortured by America's sock puppet regime in Jordan. And then he found a higher calling in life and went off to join up with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and all of that, and became Iraq War II's worst Al-Qaeda leader and all that kind of thing. Helped create the Islamic State, really, or the early version of it after the invasion, of course. But important point to make for the young listening. But anyway, so yeah, there's that. And then, I was going to ask you if you could please relate to the audience what it was that Soltan told you about the kinds of torture and what's really going on there. Paint a picture of an Egyptian prison and why somebody might become a terrorist leader after they suffered through one.
Right. So basically, people were held in underground dungeons where they didn't see any sunlight or the sky for potentially years and years. And they'd be repeatedly tortured by their guards in the worst ways possible. Beatings, abuse, sexual abuse, humiliation day in and day out. And, the conditions were awful. There would, food would be terrible. They'd constantly be goaded into committing suicide and even encouraged to commit suicide and given the tools to do that. It would just be the most dehumanizing and seemingly hopeless situation one could possibly imagine. And in such a situation, inevitably, groups like Islamic State, which propose very radical solutions, can find a foothold.
I mean, and that's amazing to even think of, leaving razor blades in the guy's cell. Go ahead, dude. Put yourself out of your misery and this kind of thing. Like, dang. And then, I don't want to spoil it. Everybody go read this horrifying nightmare of an article here. ISIS recruitment thrives in brutal prisons. But I think people get the idea real quick. And then it's interesting, too, the way he describes it. You have a couple of different references to the fact that everybody in there is just absolutely broken spirits. I mean, they have been through extraordinary rendition for sure, except the ISIS guys, who are all smiles because the world is theirs. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so look, as you mentioned, there's people are understandably very depressed and hopeless in these jails. But the ISIS guys, they're the only ones who they have any hope for their vision for society being implemented in any place. And they hear about the outside world and they get a steady stream of reports about their group expanding in Iraq and Syria and Libya and the Sinai Peninsula. And they're like, look, there's no hope of the liberals or leftists ever coming to power. There's no hope of the Brotherhood ever coming back into power. The only people who have any hope of their ideals ever being achieved are us. So they'd have a very condescending attitude towards everybody else, and they would sort of be a lot of mockery of those people, very overt mockery of those people who had believed in democracy, which was pretty much everyone else in jail. And they said, well, you put your faith in this, and look how things turned up for you. You're in a dungeon, and the whole world's okay with that. And it becomes very, they're contemptuous and arrogant because in a way, they and the regime are the only ones who are winning.
Yeah. Well, now, was there any sense that the people who really don't subscribe to that and aren't going to, that they were being reaffirmed in their belief in little d democracy, however defined, or they were all just hoping to survive and that was it at that point?
What Soltan told me is that for the most part, people just focus on survival. But, when you're in there for so long, inevitably some people, they can start, but these ideas easily start making sense to them. And then, they're like, well, there's no other option. And, democracy just seems like a joke now. There's not any prospect of democracy happening in Egypt anytime soon. Whereas just a few years ago, it seemed like the dawn of a new great era. And that's all come crashing down with a regime, which is, almost unarguably worse than the Mubarak regime that preceded it.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, too, is even from an American imperial point of view, it seems like, betting on Egyptian democracy for, the medium term at least would have been the best bet. As he says in here, this dictatorship is not stable, as you say. This place is a whole powder keg now. And, creating a military dictatorship will have the outside appearance of stability, maybe, but you're just making matters worse. But, really, the you know, putting the lid on the pot makes it boil over faster kind of a thing. And it seems like leaving those old, you know, conservative old Muslim Brotherhood leaders, elected ones in power, would have been a lot better way to take the pressure of the young radicals off. And instead, they did exactly the wrong thing. And I have to admit that even reading your article, it just makes it sound like our government does nothing but read all of our warnings about everything they do, and they just use it as a script, and that they're doing it on purpose at this point. It's like, it's almost hard to imagine that they could be this ham-handed in the way that they do their business. But
yeah, it's really sad. Like, everything that's been done has played exactly in the hands of the most radical people. And look, it doesn't have to be, we don't have to say that all hope is lost now, nothing can be done. There's things the U.S. can do right now. They're giving this aid to Egypt. They don't have to cut it off per se, but at minimum, they can say, if we're giving you billions of dollars a year, you should address the situation in your prisons to make sure this is not happening. Mm-hmm. You should impose some sort of, or restore some semblance of a democratic process to society again, so people can say, well, look, we don't have to join ISIS. There's other ways, even the faintest glimmer of hope, that we can achieve our goals within normal, peaceful channels within Egypt. But unfortunately, the U.S. so far has been giving Sisi just a blank check to do whatever he wants, and they'll continue funding his regime, which I think will be looked back upon as a mistake if it's not rectified in the near future.
Yeah, well, the vice president called, or no, pardon me, the secretary of state, Kerry, called the military coup the restoration of democracy. So they've made their position pretty clear, I guess. Thanks very much. Come back on the show, Murtaza. Great work here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Murtaza Hussein, y'all. He's at The Intercept. ISIS recruitment thrives in brutal prisons run by U.S.-backed Egypt. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys. Oh, yeah. Headphones.
Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Gareth Porter on the line. Hey, man, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Glad to be back again. Thanks, Scott.
Happy to have you. Hey, so everybody, Gareth Porter. He wrote the book Manufactured Crisis. It's the book on Iran's nuclear program and what it never was and what it is. Manufactured Crisis. Okay. Also, he wrote about 10,000 articles you should probably go back and read because they're really good. This one is called The Real Reason for Turkey's Shootdown of the Russian Jet. So I know you're going to want to tell us what before you tell us why. So first tell us what. The Turks shot down a Russian jet under what circumstances, Gareth?
Well, the circumstances were that, I mean, it depends on what you mean by the exact circumstances.
Well, you just go ahead and talk about whichever ones you think are
important.
Yeah,
I mean, the exact circumstances were that Russian planes were flying somewhere in the general vicinity of the Turkish-Syrian border. Northwest Syria. And the Turks, of course, had already been involved very deeply in northern Syria. We can talk about that a little bit more. In fact, we should talk about that a little bit more as part of the context of this event. More specifically, the Russian planes, based just south of the city of Latakia, in the same province where the the planes were operating had been carrying out bombing as well as reconnaissance missions against primarily the al-Nusra front-led alliance or coalition, I should say, of forces that were in control, essentially, of that territory in northern Latakia province abutting the Turkish border. So that is a very important immediate part of the context in which the shoot down took place. But more specifically, in terms of the claims made by both sides, the Turks, of course, claimed that the Russian planes had penetrated the airspace of Turkey for 17 seconds, and they referred and showed in their graphic of the event, their version of the graphic, that there was something that I call the parrot's beak. Really, it resembles the parrot's beak, which was made famous during the Indochina War because it was the part of Cambodia that jutted into Vietnam. But, I mean, it had a similar sort of shape. And so that's where the Turkish government claimed the Russian planes had penetrated. The Russian version of the radar path that their planes took, of course, is very different, and they show that it went south of the parrot's beak, what I call the parrot's beak, and never penetrated the airspace itself. So that's the immediate context of this issue. The Turks were claiming that they had given 10 separate warnings to the Russian fighter pilots when they were in the sky, already in the air, over a space of just 5 minutes. Now, you know, that in itself would be quite an important bit of information if it were true. But what I show in my article, and this is where we get into the analysis, is that it was impossible, given the speed of the Russian Su-24 fighter plane, based on the essentially a copy in some ways of the U.S. F-111 fighter plane. The speed was such that if the Turks actually gave warnings over a space of 10 minutes, if they began, 5 minutes before the shootdown, the Russian planes would have actually been flying in the wrong direction. They would have been flying away from the general direction of that parrot's beak of the of Turkish territory. So that simply could not have been true, based on the known speed, which the closest I could come to estimating it is about 871 miles per hour, which is more than it's supersonic speed. And even if the Russian planes had slowed down somewhat from their general cruising speed at low altitude, which this flight would have been, it would not have been more than about, 100 miles per hour less. And if so, it would still have made it impossible for the Turkish version of events to have been true. So that's the essence of my analysis of the immediate event itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems kind of funny that they would even say, oh, yeah, we were warning them for 5 minutes, when then their accusation is that they were passing over this very tiny little slice of territory. It's not even a consistent case they're making on the face of it, unless I missed a part.
Their case was based on the notion that they had warned the Russian planes while they were on their way toward that space, that part of Turkish territory that jutted into Syria. But what I show is that even that was not true. I mean, it was simply impossible because at 5 minutes before the shootdown, the Russian planes, according to both the Russian and the Turkish versions of the flight path, was still so close to the final point of impact that it was impossible that it could have actually been 5 minutes before the event. because of how fast they were going. And again, according to both flight paths. So I think this is a very dramatically telling point, which of course has not made it into a commercial news coverage of the event.
Mm-hmm. All right. But then, so, okay, it's gone from doesn't make much sense to disproven. But then, so what does that show or prove, Gareth?
Well, I mean, I think the point that I add to this analysis, which is most of my article, really, is that the Turks actually had issued two warnings just a few days before this shootdown, in which first the Turkish foreign minister and then the Turkish prime minister had warned the Russians in two separate events, but very closely connected in time, that they must cease their operations in that part of northern Syria in Latakia province, because on one hand the threat was that the Russian planes were bombing the Turkmen population of that part of Syria, and that was intolerable, and that if it didn't stop, there would be serious consequences. That the Turks would ensure that there were serious consequences. The second warning was that the Turkish government was afraid that the continued bombing would produce a flood of refugees across the border from Syria into Turkey, and that too was unacceptable, and therefore Turkey would have to take actions, and specifically it was stated that those actions would be both in Syria and in Turkey. Now, that's a pretty strong warning, suggesting very clearly that Turkey would take action which would not be limited to Turkish territory. So, I think that has to be viewed as a critical part of the understanding of what the Turkish government was up to in this event.
All right, y'all, we'll be right back with more Gareth Porter. The real reason for Turkey's shootdown of the Russian jet at MiddleEastEye.net.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm talking about the big war in Syria. The Turkish shoot down of the Russian fighter bomber. The ambush and the what for here. And Gareth, if I read you right, what you're telling us here is there's a group of anti-Assad Turkic rebels of one or another other description. I don't know which other adjectives one might place on them. Allies of Al-Qaeda, maybe not. In effect, de facto, or de jure, I don't know. But
let me just pick up from that question,
sure,
because I think that's precisely right. But it's only part of the reality that underlies this this sort of crisis between Turkey and Russia over Syria. Yes, there were Turkmen military units organized by or certainly with the support of the Turkish government, and something that I didn't have in my article, but which has been reported recently, is that Turkish special forces units called the Maroon Berets have actually, over the past several months, gone into Syria to train some of these, if not all of these Turkish military brigades. So they are located not just in Latakia province, but in other northern provinces of Syria as well. So they do, in fact, as you suggested in the beginning of your question, they are part of a broader coalition of jihadist-led forces. Essentially, al-Nusra Front is the primary force in the lead with regard to the mostly foreign fighters who are fighting against the Assad regime in northern Syria on the Turkish border. And that coalition, again led by al-Nusra Front, has been in control of a lot of territory between the Turkish border and I can't tell you exactly how many miles south from there, but a number of miles south, which includes the area called the Turkmen Mountain area, where some of these Turkish military units, the Turkmen brigades, have been located. So really what we're looking at here is that the Turkmen population have been integrated militarily into a much larger and more powerful military force led by al-Nusra Front. It also includes Arar al-Sham, which actually has, in the country as a whole, in Syria as a whole, they have more fighting forces than al-Nusra Front, according to the estimates that I've seen. And this is the primary force that the Turkish government has been counting on to put pressure on the Assad regime, not just to put pressure on it, but to bring about regime change, if at all possible. So the point that I'm making here is that whatever role the Turkmen fighters may have played, they were part of a larger force that has been in control, led by the al-Nusra Front since 2012. They have tried to enlarge that. Last year, they tried to move all the way to the Mediterranean coast of Latakia province to take over a Christian town, a small city. It was beaten back ultimately by the Assad regime with partly with air power. And during that fight, a Syrian jet was shot down. Pay attention to this, was shot down by the Turkish Air Force without any warning whatsoever. Again, this is just south of the Turkish border, but very clearly in Syrian territory.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, I guess, answer me this. If Obama really wanted the Turks to back off their push for regime change in Syria, then we would know it because they would have to back off. And he's doing this at American behest, basically, right? I mean, is there any daylight I'm supposed to believe between American power and Turkish power on this?
Well, I think there is daylight in certainly some of the details of the way the Turks are handling this. And, I'm not going to suggest that the United States was involved in the decision to shoot down the Russian plane. I doubt that very much. I don't think the United States would have wanted that to happen. In other words, a premeditated shoot down is not something the United States would have wanted. Now, of course, we know that the Obama administration has stepped up and said, yes, of course, Turkey has the right to defend their airspace, and essentially defended the Turkish view, the Turkish version of what happened in the shootdown, even though I have reason to believe that the Pentagon knows better. I think that they've looked at the data and that they undoubtedly understand precisely what I just talked about just a few minutes ago. So the question is, it's not so much whether the Obama administration has the potential or theoretical leverage to force this issue with the Turks. I'm not sure about the answer to that. It's in a sense a hypothetical question. What I do know is that the Obama administration does not have any incentive to call the Turks on the whole policy of deep involvement in supporting the jihadist forces in Latakia province and Idlib province.
Ignorant and naive, Gareth. I keep thinking that, well, you know, after the fall of Mosul and the declaration of the caliphate, I mean, they're going to at least have to start slowly turning this thing around, right? And then a year and a half goes by, couple of attacks in Paris, one big one especially. Well, now they're going to have to, you know, and even Hillary Clinton says at the Council on Foreign Relations and Obama's former CIA chief, as you noted in a previous article, maybe we're going to have to prioritize and not get rid of Assad so soon. But they really don't seem to be turning this thing around at all. As you quote in your article to end here, hilariously, the president of the United States says, well, that's the Russians' fault, more or less, for when they should focus solely on Daesh. And exactly. That is amazing.
The idea is the Russians were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's their fault. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and they put themselves there because what are they doing bombing Al-Qaeda?
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
Well, I mean, in fact, as I think we've talked about before on your show, the U.S. policy clearly does view al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, as a part of the overall set of tools with which to put pressure on the Assad regime in order to achieve the explicit goal that the U.S. government now is stating that they're pursuing in Syria, which is to bring about a transitional government in which there's already prior agreement that Assad will step down at a certain point in the transition. So they're not calling for the immediate dismissal of Assad, and they are claiming at least to be in favor of holding on to preserving the basic state structure, a secular state structure such as the one we see now in Syria, as well as the Syrian military. And I do tend to think that they are serious about that, because the consequences of having that be destroyed are so immensely horrible that I cannot imagine that any semi-rational government would say, yeah, let's try to see if we can't do that. So I think that it's a fair summary of the actual policy that the United States is trying to achieve that goal. And I think what they're not saying, of course, but which is true, is that al-Nusra Front figures very strongly in that, even though the U.S. is not going to allow them to come to the negotiating table, is going to say, no, they're terrorists. We can't have any truck with them. But Ahrar al-Sham, which is their ally, their biggest ally, and fights alongside the al-Qaeda people, is definitely going to be invited to participate, as well as other fighting brigades that are part of that al-Nusra Front-led coalition. Mm.
Well, David Cameron, of course, they're having this big fight in the UK right now over the war in the parliament, and he says that there's 70,000 moderates that can be relied on to take on all comers here.
That is one of history's great frauds, I must say. I mean, no one, absolutely no one, even those people who support the so-called moderates, really believe that for a moment. I mean, that was the theoretical estimate at the very height of the moderates back in 2011 or early 2012. And ever since then, of course, they've basically disappeared. And everybody knows that. And so Cameron is just blowing smoke. It's that simple.
Yeah. Well, it's a hell of a story. Thanks for writing about it.
Thank you, Scott, as always.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. He's at MiddleEastEye.net, the real reason for Turkey's shoot down of the Russian jet. See y'all tomorrow.